You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CivCast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to CivCast. My name is Kyle, and I'm joined here by my co-host, Dan. Hello, Dan.
Good morning.
How are you today, sir?
I'm doing all right. Nursing a bit of a Canada Day. What's the word I want to hear? Well, post-Canada Day softness, we'll call it. Too many Canadians, a bit too much poutine.
Hey, that happens. I mean, it's an exciting day. We're about to have our America Day here on 2 days from now. It's going to happen on Tuesday. But hey, we got another person here, Valter. Hello, Valter.
Hey, Colin. Just thinking, we don't have a Netherlands Day. I think we should have one. We have a King's Day, but that's not the same.
Oh, that sounds
even President's
better.
Day as well.
Yeah, that's not really that's not such a thing for us, though. We don't, like, really celebrate that day. Mm. King's Day sounds more fun. You've described this in some cold opens, I think, and it sounds way more exciting to me.
King's Day is a hell of a good fun.
No one drinks on President's Day, let me put it that
Especially King's Night, because that's the moment that you drink, not necessarily King's Day. That's when you're hungover.
I see. Okay. Well, no one drinks on either of those for us. It's kind of like a bank holiday, so boring.
That's something.
But hey, we're here to announce some Civilization CivCast news, I should say. We're doing the CivCast Challenge update this week. Valter came up with this one, so I'm going to pass it to him and let him tell you guys the new roles. This one's going to run from July 2nd, which is today, to the end of the month, July 29th. So take it away, Valter.
All right, yeah. So I came up with this one, so it's going to be a little bit weird because I like to do things that I haven't tried myself yet. And one of the things that I haven't tried myself yet is start at a different age. So normally you start in the earliest age that's available, but we're gonna mix it up a little bit and start in a different age. And we're going to start in the Renaissance age in this game. So that means that you're already halfway through the game. I mean, tag-wise at least. So that is weird, right? But to make the game span about the same amount of time that you are behind your PC, that's about 500 turns, we're also going to drop down the speed. So instead of playing on standard speed, we're going to play on epic speed. That makes it 50% slower, so the normal game would last 750 turns instead of 500. But since we're starting at turn 291, because you're starting in the Renaissance Age, it's about still 500 turns. So that sounds good to me. You can choose whoever you want to play as, and your opponents you can leave random, or you can choose your opponents if you desire. We're going to play on a normal small, the default for Civ 6 map size. The map that we're going to use is Continents. The difficulty, as always, is Emperor. And I wish you guys a lot of success, because this is something I'm not sure how to deal with. And I'm really looking forward to what you guys are going to encounter.
I'm so excited for this one, because this is something I actually do quite often. So I really like starting in different eras, because it really changes up your gameplay style. So I'm really excited to see how people play it. You're going to have different settler amounts and all kinds of stuff like that. So you're going to have to make it changes up your whole first couple moves, like the previous couple way you do it for launching from the ancient era, totally different. The wonders that you can get are different. Not like new wonders, but you can't get some older ones, and therefore that changes your prioritization. So very excited for these stories to come out. I also think that means you can't build any ancient era wonders, because I think you're limited to just one era before. So if this is Renaissance,
sure.
I think it means you can just pull from medieval. So we'll see. We'll see. But it's going to make for some interesting stories, I have no doubt. We're going to get these notes up there on the Reddit. So that is civcast.reddit.com. There'll be a sticky post up at the top. Thanks to Dan for shouting out all those awesome victories last week. We had a record number of people play June CivCast Challenge. Maybe it's because of the summer. Maybe it's because everyone's eagerly sitting by their computers waiting for these new DLC leaders to come out. I know I am. Which also, guys, just, you know, before we dive into some main discussions this week, what do you think? I mean, we should be getting close to these guys, right? I mean, we expected maybe late June, so early July. What do you think? Do you think
it was leaked that July would be released something by the company that does the ports for Mac and Linux? So should be somewhere July. I don't remember if they said anything like early or late July, but yeah. I mean, they did say something like that.
Guys, it's day two of July. I'm losing it.
No kidding, me too. But I mean, like, there was that one mention in the r/Civ that talked about how they had been consistently delivering their content around like the third week, I think, of the month. I believe it was like the third week of the month. And that wouldn't surprise me this time around with the whole North American summer update thing if it came like July 22nd or something like that.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean,
we know that it has been pushed out towards the beta testers quite a while now. So it's already late in my eyes. So I would expect it literally any week, the announcement. Yo, it's coming.
Hurry for access. Hurry. I need my fix, guys. I need some new leaders to play with. Please help me.
Yeah. We're hitting our wrists here. We need that fix.
I know. Yeah. Okay. Now that I'm taking it there.
Any more of those leaders, perhaps?
Sweet, sweet leader.
So you can see for access, we're literally jonesing for your fix here. So one thing we wanted to dive in on this week is to go further in depth on Civilization V, because people seem to really like that conversation. We had a lot of great back and forth taking place over on the Reddit on the actual episode post. So big thanks to Dash Rip and VectorCat for chiming in. VectorCat wrote some awesome, I think, Voucher, did you call it a dissertation there? Some very in-depth. Here, let's see. I can put this up on the screen for people. Flip. Where's the button? There you go. He wrote this nice long post with some really good juicy details talking about both game mechanics and all kinds of things, but we'll get to that in a minute. First, I wanted to start, we'll just start chronologically here and talk about Dash Rip. He chimed in commenting on how our conversation, I guess, was about the World Congress and how we want it to come back. We're excited to see how that looks. But he brought up something very interesting that we hadn't touched on, and I hadn't even really got to that stage of thinking about, which is he's thinking that we shouldn't be able to vote for ourselves in the World Congress. So if you didn't play Civ 5, or if you don't remember how that system worked, the World Congress came about every couple turns. Once you got to a certain, when did the World Congress start? Was it a time period that brought it about, or was it you had to unlock a tech or something?
It was when one civilization had discovered everybody and got printing press tech.
Got it. Okay. Thank you, Valter. That does now sound very, very familiar. And then you also got extra delegates if you were the first person to do that, I believe. Something like that.
You were automatically hosting the council. You're hosting the council, you get extra delegates.
So his point here is you get your extra delegates by winning over city states, and then you can use all those points to vote for both policies to go through, but also vote for who's going to be the world leader. Dash Rip's point is that if it comes into Civ 6 in a similar fashion, you should not be able to vote for yourself because it doesn't really play into the diplomacy factor so much. You're not really trying to get on the AI's good side. And as the resident warmonger here, I think, I had countered him by saying that that's going to make it really hard if you're a warmonger and want to take charge of the World Council or anything like that. It's going to make for a very interesting thing. And we talked about the fear system. So and how AIs in the game in Civ 6 don't really respond to a fear system. I wanted to throw it to both of you and get your takes on this fear system to know if you guys have had any luck with it. Because so far, when I make demands on Civs and Civ 6, I've actually gotten like two people to give in to me, but not many. So, Dan, do you want to talk about any experiences you might have had with that?
Sure. In Civ 6, I do find that they don't really seem to care very much. I mean, this speaks, of course, to the AI in general and the fact that it is still an evolving thing and something that out of the gate wasn't the best. Off the top of my head, I can think of at least one instance where the AI acted very, very weirdly in the face of my clearly, their imminent demolition, their imminent destruction, or however you want to put it. I think it was with my China game, and this is months ago, but I was going up against, I want to say, Greece with Pericles, and he had a lot of cities. And I had a huge army, and I plowed through at least his first two or three frontier cities. And so what I basically did was he had very little resistance. I offered him a deal where I took, and I don't know if one of you guys can speak to whether the likelihood of this is extremely low, but I offered where I took his two other cities that were nearby, just took them peacefully and, you know, kind of granted him that he could keep his capital in one other city or something like that. I was negotiating like it's like a sports trade or something like that. I'm like, you give me your two cities, I'll let you keep your two cities. Yeah, yeah. And he was just like, no. And so I was like, okay, well, whatever, screw it. So I just went and conquered them and beat him anyway. So certainly it doesn't seem to be the most logical, although I guess that kind of makes sense. I mean, who is going to just surrender two of their cities to you in real life in a situation like that?
So you make hard deals there, Dan. That's what it sounds like. Not just one of your cities. I want two. Actually, I want all the ones surrounding your capital. No. I'm not going to siege your capital afterwards. I just want them.
Yeah, well, you got to, you know, you got to start high, right? That's negotiation. You got to say, you know, you got to aim a little high. And if he comes back and says, okay, I'll give you one, I'll be like, okay, how about you give me one in a city state? We split the difference.
I mean, he learns his negotiations probably from watching the Canucks do that trade policy.
Oh,
hold on.
That sounds like shots fired.
I'm so confused. Did you just make a hockey reference?
I did.
Wow.
And I was riffing on the Canucks and how good their trade policy is.
This is right after Canada Day. It's raw, man. It's raw. You can't. You just.
Oh my God.
Canada has. Wow.
I teared up.
Wow, Dan.
That was a Canada Day, Dan. That was a Canada Day.
That was just, that blew my mind. I don't know if you saw me on live stream, folks, but I actually did one of those like Disney double takes where you go, blah, 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 blah.
See, there you go. Okay, shameless plug. That's why you need to be watching the live stream. So check that out.
Yeah.
Valter, how about you? Have you had any experiences with these that you're making a demand and... I feel like it's not even a useful mechanic half the time. What's your take?
So I've never in the 600 hours that I have in this game or so actually made a flat demand.
What?
I usually try to be friends with all the civilizations if I can, as long as I can. I have had situations like Dan described where I was at war with somebody and I didn't want to conquer them completely. I just wanted to take like the nearest city and I'd be done with it. And I have had actually that they said like, yeah, okay, sure. Just take that god-awful city and be done with it. Usually it is a small city with not that much going on around it. I've never succeeded in taking a big one, but... I've been able to take some, but that was only when I was clearly superior and they were literally going to die if they didn't. So, yeah, that saved us both a lot of trouble, me a lot of warmonger penalty, since, yeah, I like to be friends with everybody.
I know.
They're like, you want what city? Boise, Idaho. Yeah, okay, you can have it. Just
hey, I hear Boise's a
actually?
Nice place.
Well, here, please.
I hear
we're just
going
to give
nice.
It to you.
Now that they're like my neighbor up the road or something or to the side, I'm supporting them for some reason. And I've never been there, but I hear it's a great place. So we're keeping it. But I think Dash Rip actually, I think he said this in a way that I very much like. It's something I support. He said the biggest problem with the AI at the moment is that they hate to give up anything, regardless of how bad they are losing. Makes me wish they implemented a fear system that would override the warmonger status. Maybe if they see you have a large army and are prone to war, they will give in to your demands for a promise of peace. I understand that. So to Valter, I think that's very interesting that you in 600 hours really haven't made any flat demands. I feel like the demand system, seeing has been baked into Civ 5 and stuff, we've had it for a while. I wish it were something else. If the game didn't have the system, period, I'd understand that. That's fine. If that's not the direction you guys, Firaxis, are aiming at, that's cool. But seeing as it's in there, I feel like it's almost like an empty button half the time. And I think Dash said it in a good way because of them being afraid of your warmonger status. They just get angry at you if you go to war with other civilizations or you take their cities. I added on to his point, and I talked about this in the cold open. I said, Cleopatra, who demands that you have the largest army to be her friend, she'll threaten you. And then at that point, you can be taking her cities, actively destroying or capturing them, and with your big army, and she's mad at you then because you have too big of an army, or you're a warmonger, or whatever. It's like, well, but there's such a conflict of interest in these agendas. I don't know which direction to go. It's a lose-lose for me.
Quick question, yes. Actually, though. Have you ever had the AI demanded something you give them without you getting anything in return? Because I don't think I have.
No, I haven't. Now, I was thinking about this earlier while you guys were talking. I have not had that happen.
No, me neither. So, like, because in Civ 5, I could regularly remember that the AI did that to me. They were like, give me this or else, you know, what's coming? And I was like, I sure have it, right? And also like, hey, we're good friends. Here, you can have this, or please, can you lend me this? And that in that system, actually, it worked well. You got stuff, you gave stuff, and you could demand stuff, actually. But in Civ 6, I mean, the system kind of technically exists, but I just don't think it's being utilized at all. Like, the AI doesn't do it to you. They don't do it to each other, then, I assume, either. And therefore, they won't be very receiving to you when you demand anything from them.
I think we have come to an epiphany here, everybody, that the system doesn't really fully exist. It's a shell. Maybe that's something that they do add on to. I mean, maybe that's what we get in a new expansion or some sort of large sweeping patch, is maybe they do start to fill in that those parts of the AI's, you know, functionality and things in that way. I mean, if it is there, if it's in to that degree, it seems strange that it wouldn't.
Or it is in there for multiplayer. I mean, I could see that happening, actually.
That could be. That's a very good point, Roger. I didn't even think about it in that sense.
I mean, that's the same thing that I was thinking about earlier when you started reading his post about not voting for yourself in the diplomatic victory.
Mm-hmm.
That would immediately mean that there would be no diplomatic victory possible on a multiplayer game because nobody's going to vote for you.
Oh, that's a good point.
And I don't like that. And that's the sole reason already why I wouldn't want that system, because that would make the diplomatic victory impossible in a multiplayer game, unless somebody like throws the game and gives you the victory, which would result in angerness by everybody else and stuff like that. So that system, unfortunately, wouldn't work in multiplayer, and therefore it kind of can't exist, unfortunately.
So wait, you're saying you are in favor of voting for yourself. Is that right?
Yes.
Now, and maybe I'm not thinking this through the right way, so you correct me if I'm wrong. Couldn't you, let's say you and I are facing off against one another, couldn't you just win over all the AIs more so than I have and throw their votes towards you?
No. I mean in a pure multiplayer game.
Oh, with no AI. I see. Okay. Well, that's a good point. Yeah. I haven't even stumbled into one of those before. I mean, not that I doubt that people do those, but I just that's very interesting. Well,
they're being done quite a bit.
That's so very interesting. So they couldn't do that.
And they would be really angry if you completely dismiss the diplomatic victory if it gets introduced into the game, that they can't participate in that. And I agree, that would be silly.
Well, then that's good for me, because that means that I don't have to be nice to the AI any more than I already am, and I can continue to pillage and burn their cities to the ground and vote for myself at the end. I just make sure they have less delegates by destroying all the cities that have more delegates than me.
I mean, that's a valid excuse, right? And
right.
I mean, there makes some sense in it, coming back to the fear system.
Right.
You conquering a lot of those AIs and stuff like that, and have your votes based, like in the last Civ, it was based on your city state, so like how much power you could project around the globe for minor civilizations, pretty much like your sphere of influence.
Mm-hmm.
But in Civ 4, for example, you had a similar kind of thing, like the predecessor of the World Council, and there it was actually based upon a percentage of population, and I like that a lot.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So the amount of votes that you had, it started first with the Apostle Palace when that was built. You started to have like this religious diplomatic council kind of. And based upon how many percentage population of that religion in which it was built, you had in your country living, that you had more votes and stuff like that. And later on when the UN was built, it was literally about population flat. So if you had 50% of the population in the world, you controlled 50% of the votes, which would make sense because you are such a large country, you have more diplomatic say in what goes on in the world than the rest.
Mm-hmm.
For example, somebody who has like 2% population, a tiny one city. So yeah, I really like that, and you could definitely do something like that again.
That does make sense. Dan, any thoughts on that system?
Yeah, you know, I think building on the idea of it, I think that diplomatic is not something that is inherently or not something that you can inherently use in multiplayer, because so much of diplomatic is all about these kind of, on what Wouter's saying, if I'm understanding him correctly, on these, you know, pre-programmed in caveats for relationships that the AI is going to develop. Humans don't do that. In a multiplayer game, I've always found that alliances in a multiplayer game are about as good as a piece of wet paper. Like, someone will be allied with you or tell you, you know, oh, you know, we'll be peaceful together, until they see that you're going to win, in which case they'll just throttle you, or they're, you know, because everyone's in the end out for themselves, whereas with the AI, it's different. But as it relates to diplomacy, I think that we talked months and months back about the idea of, and again, I think this is echoing what Wouter's saying, if I'm understanding him correctly, but the idea of having something like the spheres of influence, and having diplomacy be something maybe that's more goal-oriented, having something where if you have a partnership or an alliance with someone, perhaps you as a group are given goals or are given tasks or something like that, where if you succeed and accomplish those tasks as a team or together or as part of your alliance, you know, a la research agreements or joint wars or something, but ramped up, then you get more points towards perhaps a joint victory, where maybe you are able to win a game as an alliance, as a group of two or three, as opposed to just by yourself. Because in the end, any game I ever played in Civ 5 or Civ 6 that's multiplayer with other people, they say, screw our alliance, I don't care about it, one person wins this game, I'm not just going to let you win, sorry. And, you know, it ends up being, you know, military in the end, or domination focused in the end. So if you give them the impetus to stick through with an alliance and say, you can win as a group of two or a group of three, like, say, I don't know, every war ever fought, then it literally makes sense. Like
NATO versus Warsaw Pact style.
Yeah, absolutely. And that builds on the whole sphere of influence thing too. And you could do that with city states, where if they are in your sphere or in your alliance structure, you can make it happen. I think that would be a better way, I think, to integrate in diplomacy that would allow for it to be viable in multiplayer.
Yeah, I would agree with something like that. That would sound really interesting. You have to limit it to a certain amount of people, otherwise you're going to have 7 versus 1, for example, which sucks, because then you're the only one not winning and stuff like that. But yeah, I think you really, really could do something with that indeed. But to be fair, I mean, I think that diplomacy system, like it was in Civ 5, for example, worked really well in multiplayer as well, in pure multiplayer games. Because the World Council, you still had like, okay, we really want to bomb out that guy, so we're just going to vote for those kinds of things.
Yes.
And when it comes to like the final victory, usually be quite close. There was somebody gearing up for diplomatic victory, getting all the votes, and just having to wait like 6 more turns until the council convenes, and then I can vote myself world leader. And somebody else who is like, oh, but I'm 5 turns away from the science victory, so yeah, I'm going to win, baby. I mean, it worked well enough that it actually, the diplomatic victory with full players was viable. And I like that. And I think if you base it on population, something like that again, or like a sphere of influence could add to your population, like your sphere of influence population-wise is how much influence you have on the council, then that would be perfect. I would love that.
Yeah. There are a lot of those little kind of small things in the diplomatic system in Civ 5 that I love playing around with, like that one where you could vote to have a luxury resource no longer really matter or no longer really count as a luxury resource. So if someone had something and had a monopoly over it or whatever, and you're mad at that, but you don't have to necessarily go to war to them. You can ostensibly embargo their economy by saying this resource doesn't matter anymore or whatever. Right? That's cool. That's strategic, you know? And that kind of thing absolutely is something that you can transfer over to what you were saying. Yeah.
We're banning
also the
crabs.
Great projects that you can list up there.
What's that, Kyle?
We're banning crabs. They always tried to ban a luxury resource for me, so then I would just ban trade for them.
Banning crabs. You can't ban a living thing.
You can embargo people, and I love the great projects that you could do out of there, like, and get nice bonuses from that. I love the World Council. I'm really looking forward to seeing that back, because they did promise that.
Yes, they did, and I'm super curious to see how it's implemented. I like the ideas that you guys were throwing back and forth there, because, I mean, we really can't as the system currently stands, I mean, we all basically produce the same amount of envoys. And if envoys are our equivalent to gold at city states, we can't necessarily do it in the same way unless it's going to be like, how many city states are you the suzerain of? But I don't like that system. I'd rather them try and toss in something either a far back stretch, like you were saying, Voucher, with population size, or come up with a kind of a new system. But I just don't want to see us try and equate gold to envoys, because that system just doesn't sound like it would be as much fun as kind of tossing in a curveball would be and just giving us something new to chew on for a while.
Yeah, or what they could do, and we've talked about this before, is like make a governmental district.
Yeah.
And you gain governmental points out of that, or diplomacy points besides the envoy, or just replacing the envoy with diplomacy points. And you have to invest diplomacy points, and you can increase that by building more of those kinds of districts. Just make it another resource like fate, for example, but just use for diplomacy.
That'd be so much fun. Oh, I can't wait. I hope we get something like that. I want to touch on a couple other things, though. So let's see. Whoops, where's my thing here? Lost it. So in that same post, or actually, I'm sorry, this is Vector Cat's other post here. He goes on to talk about how one of the differences between Civ 5 and Civ 6 that we really didn't call out last week was the fact that unique units in Civ 5, I'll read this. Very much enjoyed last week's discussion of differences between 5 and 6. I will quickly say one thing. I really miss what he really misses is unique bonuses staying with a unit after upgrading. For example, Berber Cavalry, for instance, upgraded to tanks. They were ridiculously powerful because tanks and armor, they came with the homeland defense and desert combat buffs that the Berber Cavalry had. And that's something I didn't even think about that we didn't have going on in Civ 6. That is such an interesting thing that kind of went by the wayside, and I'm sure that just went away due to retooling and things, but have you guys noticed that lacking as well? Have you guys missed that, or have you been like me and just totally forgot that that was even a mechanic?
I missed that a lot, because I remember when I was about to tech up to like the next unit type, mm-hmm. so that I couldn't like build any more of my unique units, I usually pushed out a ton of them just for the fact that they would keep that bonus for their upgrade. It was so powerful. And I mean, I like that. What I talked about last week was building up a national identity and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very much part of that.
That does make sense.
I agree.
One other thing Vector Cat said before we move on to talk a little bit about ideologies, he said, in Civ 6, it appears to be designed for a longer, much more difficult experience. Well, actually, sorry, there's a typo here. I can't tell which one he's talking about. He says, Civ 6 appears to be designed for a longer, more difficult experience than Civ 6. I think he means than Civ 5. Barbarians are tougher, the map seed is much more important, and the AI is usually more of a problem. The list goes on. RPGs have the benefit of narratives to balance player frustration with difficulty, and it's easier to beat one's head against the same wall over and over again when the story is compelling. He's looking at Ocarina and Diablo's click, click, click loot pattern. But RTSs don't have that same... Oh, yeah, yeah. And RTSs don't have the same ability because they don't really carry a narrative with them. And I think that's... I think he's got a very, very valid point there. It's also... I think that kind of goes to what you were saying, Voucher, about trying to build some national identities to kind of give you ideas of what to strive for in the game. To we've been talking about this for a long time when it comes down to making every decision feel very valuable. But it's just very interesting to look at the mechanics of this game. And I think that does kind of tie us in with our talk here of ideologies, because we had a massive shift between those two. And to some degrees, and I think people are on both sides of the spectrum, some would say that ideologies don't and haven't done enough to really define your play style. Some of them kind of just act like another skin on top of the policy systems. I think some other people would argue that they actually do define your play style. And if you're going to choose communism over fascism over freedom, then you are going to play in a very, very different way. And I think that's changed between the systems. So if you're unfamiliar with Civ 5 here, I'm going to toss this up on on the screen here for people watching live. In Civ 5, you had Freedom, Order, and Autocracy. And these were a totally different system than in Civ 6. In Civ 6, these are just choices within your cultural tech tree, for example. You know, you're just moving right along and you unlock them. You actually unlock all three of them to get their policy cards in Civ 6. In Civ 5, though, you chose one and you invested heavily within it. Guys, where do you stand just off the top of your heads on... Do you like the Civ 5 system better or Civ 6?
If I could quickly take this, I think that so much about the Civ 5 system, there is a lot to like about the Civ 5 system, but the Civ 5 system is very much married to the one thing about Civ 5 that I do not miss and that I did not like, and that is the mechanic of happiness. Because so much of your ideological choices and so much of what your decisions are and the revolutions that people can undertake in your cities, is so much of that is tied to the fluctuation of happiness. And so although I you know, when I look at the trees and I remind myself, I think there's a lot of really cool, you say reskinning, Kyle, that's a good way to put it. I think there's a real chance to model your Civ a certain way, depending on which of these three ideologies you take. But so much of it had to do with the mechanic of happiness and how important happiness was as a mechanic to Civ 5. So in that sense, if you were to transport this whole ideology idea over from Civ 5, it wouldn't work because you don't have a happiness mechanic, thank God, in Civ 6.
You do. Amenities is... It's really small, but it is there.
You think amenities is equivalent to happiness?
It is supposed to be the equivalent to happiness. It's local happiness for cities, but it just played down a lot in importance.
But it played down a lot more importance, is fair. It's also much more complex and a much more, you know, logical system. Happiness, mm-hmm. that smiley face at the top, in my opinion, at the top of the bar in Civ 5 was the biggest pain in the ass.
It was.
Yes. I mean, luxuries give you amenities, and that's the first clue why it's the same system.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. I don't look at them in the same function, though. Yeah.
We do. But it's like the iteration that they made for Civ 6 of the happiness system. They played it down, made it locally. You still get penalties if the city is unhappy and everything like that. But it's just based per city instead of nationally. And you get bonuses if your city is happy. So it's just the same system, but really made super easy.
Okay, but if you were to transplant this system into Civ 6, you couldn't have them necessarily... You know, the happiness is so strongly affected by your ideological. There's the three type, and I'm reminding myself here as I look at it, there's the three types of social upheaval when you change your ideology. So you couldn't have that with amenities, right?
No, I agree that those are, because that changes it enough that is near. I mean, you could technically, same as that war weariness is affecting your amenities in the city, but it wouldn't have the same effect.
So here, I finally found a photo of each of these ones to display. So, but Dan, to your point, so many of these are based on, bringing in happiness to the system as they stood in Civ 5. I mean, I know the communism one better than the other ones, but like, I think Young Pioneers was something like you getting happiness based on whatever. Universal healthcare is probably happiness or growth.
Universal healthcare was the only one that was in all the three trees, if I remember.
Was it
right?
Oh, it is. Yeah. Right. Wait, I don't even remember universal healthcare, to be honest. Why don't I
universal
remember this
healthcare
one?
Is indeed a happiness thing, and I think you got it from certain buildings. It was the one that was in every each of the three trees.
One of these is like building factories makes you happy, and so it was all based on this weird happiness mechanic that I just didn't like how it was implemented in Civ 5. I like it way more in Civ 6 if we're just talking about happiness for a second, because to that point, Dan, I mean, the happiness mechanic, I always felt it was so ridiculous because the more cities we have in our empire, the less happy we are. Okay, well, would you rather
be... That's not completely true.
I think so.
It is true.
I mean, it's a balancing mechanic.
Wait, so Dan, you're anti... Who's wet on this conversation? Who's pro, let's have a bunch of cities? No one?
What do you mean?
I guess I mean...
I want to have a bunch of cities.
In Civ 5, your city, you had less happiness. You had negative happiness coming in for the more cities you created. Who's in favor of that mechanic?
Well, I mean,
no
look,
one.
Well, I thought it was dumb.
Terrible mechanic. Then, bye bye.
No, I don't agree with that, because it had a very specific purpose, and that's a purpose that is completely missing right now in Civ 6. And it's a purpose that I think is really important, and that's the fact that you have to do something to prevent the player from going absolutely crazy with settling any position he can get. Right now in Civ 6, there is nearly no downside in settling more cities. While in Civ 5, this was the mechanic to make playing tall more viable if you did it right than playing wide. I mean, both had still its perks and possibilities, but you had to play a different game style. And in Civ 6, there is no good reason why you would play tall. You should just go as wide as you can and then go make some taller cities.
But isn't and that kind of how I we really like. Make the real world work? I mean, we just settle everywhere. I mean, we just settle. We don't have something there, we'll just settle.
Sure, but we're not making a complete real world analog here.
But
we're trying to make a fun game, and I think this is actually reducing in the funness because the AI doesn't do it correctly.
Tall isn't a fun way to play, though.
I agree.
For many people, it is.
But it's tall. But it's so isolated. Anyone who plays tall is just going to play with, you know, your two or three central cities and just be like, leave me alone, let me win a science. And I'm the biggest tenet of science victories.
I mean, but there are people who love that kind of gameplay. They just not much involved, see how the world just changes. And I like that sometimes. I mean, not all the time. I love playing wide usually. But there are enough people that actually do like playing tall and want to have it as a viable thing that they kind of miss it.
Should it be?
I think it was a good way.
I don't know.
I mean, was it perfect? Absolutely not. I mean, there's a great mod out there called the Community Balance Patch, or now it's called Fox Popoli, who does overhaul the happiness mechanic and makes it not so much as like the wide mechanic so much, but more based upon like a city, local city, like a predecessor of what the amenity system is here pretty much. Are kind of different, but that's too much in depth, I guess. But I think there should be something like dissuading you from just settling wherever you want without any penalty. You should have to, because that was the problem for many large empires, right? Your empire is too large. You can't manage such a large empire until you have like super awesome communication systems. So there should be some setback to that in the game here as well, if you want to make a real world analog. You can't have this huge Roman Empire with your primitive communications systems, because that just doesn't work. That's not how an empire works.
Okay, but does it have to be through a mechanic that is so inherently tied to everything in the game, insofar as it discourages, in a lot of cases, settling wide unless you're specific cities or unless you're far enough in the game? Maybe what you can add is you can add a stress mechanic where if you build too wide, maybe it downwardly impacts your financials, or it downwardly impacts your research capabilities, or maybe it downwardly impacts the time it takes for you to roll out units or roll out buildings because you're spreading your resources wider. I don't think it has to be this one mechanic where it's like wide equals, you know, mechanic go down, tall equals mechanic stay up. It seems too simplistic.
And that's the thing, because that's not how it worked, because playing wide also meant you had more luxury resources. And if you planned your city strategically, you could keep up with the negative modifier that came from the happiness and stuff like that. It just required you to play differently than you have to do now. Now it's literally like, where do I like to place my city? And there you had to like, okay, this is a luxury resource that I don't have. And it also made trade with other empires much more important, because you needed to get their luxury resources as well. So, and I think like putting an extra mechanic in there for that is not necessary, because you already have a mechanic that can do exactly that. It does reduce your amount of gold that you're getting. It does reduce the amount of science that you're getting. Being negative happiness is not the end of the world. You could be fine with -4 happiness. You get some penalties, but doesn't end the game for you. You don't lose automatically or something like that. And you can work then to build up your empire again and stabilize what you have currently and get in positive happiness and expand further. So
yeah, I know I'm simplifying it. I'm speaking to what Kyle was saying, though, and just the idea of the mechanic, should it be something that at base influences the other thing? And I don't think I like the way that it was structured in 5, and so I'm not missing it in 6.
No, definitely not. I think that the amenity system is much better suited for what we've got, and the fact that it at least applies, I mean, logically speaking, because I do think this, I mean, we can argue here about where we want this game to go and what we think that value should be placed on within the game. But I mean, to say that this isn't based in some sense of real world functionality, that would be a fallacy, because I mean, it is. I mean, we're dealing with cities and culture and all of the things that, I mean, these are real civilizations.
But you're not trying to emulate the real world one-on-one. It's
no, but
like
that doesn't mean we should go the opposite direction of that either. I mean, we cannot be a 100% parallel, but that also doesn't mean that we should have free reigns to just completely go off the rails and say, well, everything's out the window. I mean, the idea of a happiness system in that way doesn't really seem to make sense. Yes, you could say that there's a communication breakdown, and to that point, that at least is based in some reality. But, I mean, I don't know. I don't feel that I don't think that the mechanic, the way it was based in Civ 5, made much sense. I mean, okay, we would be happier to have one city versus five cities. Let's not talk about 1,000 cities. Let's just say, like, I'd be happier having one city instead of five.
Not completely true, because happiness, unhappiness didn't just came from more cities. It also came from large cities.
It came significantly
from... If you have five cities that have five population, they would probably be happier than one city with 20 population.
But why are we getting these huge, massive, like, negatives from having large cities as well? I mean, in my mind...
It's balance mechanic.
Well, it's a balance mechanic, but it's a balance mechanic that's not, I don't think, grounded in any reality to me.
Yeah.
I mean, a large city doesn't make... I mean, by that logic, Wouter, where you live in the world should be a hugely unhappy place, because if we're just going to have more people and more people is going to bring in more unhappiness, that just doesn't make sense to me. I understand what they're trying to do, but there's a huge logical disconnect there that could have been addressed by different things.
Again, that doesn't necessarily mean you're unhappy. It's based upon how much you did. Like, are you trading luxury resources? Are you building the correct buildings and stuff like that? And with that kind of the idea, I mean, most of the game doesn't take place in the modern era. And that is, so that analog doesn't really go.
But that's when it hit me, was in the modern era, because that's, I play tall in Civ 5. I play tall until about roughly World War II to the Cold War, because about when I get communism was typically when I start expanding my empire in Civ 5. Until that point, I traditionally do only play with about three cities. So I play tall before going wide. But the trick is then, whenever you do start to go wide, when you are in this modern communication era, and when you are already trading luxury resources, and now you're going out and collecting more yourselves, I found that that still was more of a negative net of happiness than what you were getting in from it. Now, sure, you can play it to the very end and tweak it, and you will eventually overcome the negative happiness if you're doing things correctly. But still, it was a much more miserable mechanic, because, I mean, at the end of the day, this does come down to how much fun you're having playing the game. I think that the current amenity system, as it works, has vastly more, like, I don't feel personally in the real world, me sitting at my computer, I don't feel the stress of that mechanic affecting me like I did in Civ 5 with this weird
happiness
thing.
Kind of the problem, because do you notice the mechanic?
Of amenity? Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You really do?
Yes, because I have cities that are pinging
all the games that I play, I mean, all the games that I play, I don't really give a rat's ass if amenity. I generally don't know if my cities are happy or not.
Oh yeah, I do. Definitely do. I mean,
that's
I see
one
that
reason
a lot.
I never built the happiness district. It's not a carnival, but the
entertainment district.
Entertainment,
yeah, that one.
I do build.
Unless
that.
I want to build the Colosseum, I never build the entertainment district, because amenities are not important at all. The penalties that you get from it are that minor as well. I can spare a couple of cities being a little bit unhappy.
Would you be in favor of something that isn't such an upfront mechanic like happiness? Like, I'm really hammering, maybe I'm missing whether or not this actually exists in Civ 6, but I don't think I am. Would you be in favor of it being more of a background statistical stressor or downgrade kind of mechanic on things in order to balance, as opposed to something that's as painfully upfront and black and white as happiness?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying you should reintroduce the happiness system in Civ 6, because that probably wouldn't work the way it is built right now, especially with amenities and stuff like that. But I would be in favor of including something to dissuade people from just settling cities wherever they go. That's just not realistic if you want to make a realistic kind of game. When you're in a medieval era, you can't have a nation that spans like three continents, because that's just not how it worked in the medieval era. If you did that, you would have huge troubles. It was, I mean, the Roman Empire kind of fell to that kind of things because it was too big. And those kinds of things. China toppled over many times because it was too large and there were too many different forces working inside it. So something should be there to dissuade you from going that wide, because that's just not realistic. And you said you want to have at least a realistic game.
What I'm getting from that is that it almost, I'm not saying it should be chance-based, but seeing as we are recognizing the fact that many civilizations have tried to go wide in the real world, I don't want something flat set in stone that says that you can't, because that encourages people just not to. But I like the idea. I'm not opposed to some negatives coming in, Dan, like what you're saying, some stressors. But at the same time, so I don't want such overt stressors that people just aren't going to do it. I it's kind of my argument against theory crafting. I get it. Some people, it makes them super happy, so go for it. But at the same time, I think theory crafting in video games introduces a whole unfun side of a game, because once you unlock the mechanics in a way, it limits your view of the world, your attempt of where you're going to go with it. And I think Civilization is a game that, yes, is rooted in reality to a degree, but I think it's supposed to encourage you to take the reins of that civilization and try to do what they couldn't do. So I don't want
to
go for it.
In Civ 4, you had the balance mechanic for not going extremely wide while city maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
The further you were from your capital, the more your city cost in upkeep. You could counter that by becoming more rich and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And there were, like, you could build the Forbidden Palace in your country that would act as like a second capital for distance base and stuff like that. But I kind of think that maybe something like that would work.
If we're talking literal distance, I'm sold.
Yeah, it's literally like, how far is it? How many tiles is it from your capital? And the further it was, the higher the maintenance was. So it's just based in gold. But the thing why it works so well in that game is that gold was directly tied to science. Because you chose how much of your income you would spend to science. That's why in this game it just wouldn't work so well.
Yeah.
Because science and gold are completely separated now.
So have it be more of like an empire maintenance thing. Have it be something that's affecting more than just that.
Yeah. Make it apply to science as well.
And culture, and maybe even if you integrate in diplomacy, then you can bring back the whole Civ 5 idea of inter-city revolutions. Like, you can have a city and it's I was about to say satisfaction, but then I thought Wouter would start yelling at me and asking me if that was the same thing as happiness. But you could have it be like, if you have too many cities, you know, and one's too far away, like, I don't know, the British Empire with America back in the 18th century, you know, then there's a dissatisfaction mechanic within that, or however you want to put it, that affects all of your internal resources, your money, your science, your culture, all that, and potentially has the chance for it to secede from your empire, maybe even.
I mean, I love that in Civ 4 that you actually were able to take over other cities culturally. I would love and really love to see that back. Tiles were fluid. Borders were fluid based upon your culture.
I do remember
that. It is
awesome.
I want that back.
So this is exactly, okay, so we solved it by just going back in time. See, that does exactly what I was, I think, looking for there. I don't want some weird, flat, arbitrary, not bound by like any physical sort of thing, just toss it out there, policy thing, or not, I don't know how to word this. I just don't want some blanket mechanic that's telling people, you should never go wide because of this. But I love this idea that's saying, you can go wide, sure, but you're gonna notice some really bad things. Like, you might lose that city that you're putting on the end of the world. Like, that's probably a bad idea to put it the whole way over there. We don't have the communication or the trade routes or whatever that's gonna keep that city happy and funded and, you know, maintained the same way you can if it's 6 hexes from your capital city. That makes sense to me in both a real world sense and in the game sense. It wouldn't prevent people from going wide, but it would encourage people to be mindful that if you really are going to toss it to the end of the world, you're going to sit that place up there in the Antarctics or whatever, that you might lose that city in the end because you just can't maintain it logically, logistically. I like it.
And
I love
it. And you can have buildings that in the city that reduced that penalty, for example, which they had before. Like, I don't know, with colonization, you unlock a governor's office or something like that. You can build in the city to reduce that penalty.
Love it.
This would work. I'm sold. So basically, like I said, our thing is to go back in time to Civ 4. But I also, to that point,
Civ
4
was the best civilization game they made so far, in my opinion.
Why
so
is it that everyone
like
is... Well, they're going to probably remake it, right?
I really do. So I tend to go back to that and see what they did.
Oh, gosh. I feel like everyone's just remaking their older games. I don't know what that says about us right now, but so many people were just like, let's remake it.
I mean, Civ 6 is definitely not a remake of Civ 4 and neither Civ 5. So they are definitely not remaking their old games. They are definitely going different paths. But
I think my answer
is
just
remake seeing a little bit back of it.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't miss I want back the idea of those fluid cultural borders, like you're saying. But we're actually getting short here on time. We're down to basically our last 10 minutes. Are you guys happy with our...
It was a good chat.
It was a very good one.
It was really good.
I loved it. That was probably one of our most intensive thought debates on here in a long time.
It was.
Copper Cutter, what do you say, Valter? He said, might not apply, but didn't India's unique Civ ability circumvent the whole happiness versus population topic?
Yeah, India was really good in Civ 5 in going tall because they didn't get the penalty for population in their cities to have
that's who it was. Yeah, I couldn't remember who it was.
Makes a lot of sense. Dan, do you want to take it away with your historical minute this week and maybe give people a little hint of what you did for your historical extra for June?
Yeah, that's actually what I was going to do. I was going to talk a little bit about the historical extra. So for those of you who don't know, as part of the Patreon reward system, at which point again is it, Kyle?
That is, I think, the $5 a month one.
Yeah, $5.
Yeah, so once a month I hop on to Audacity, Discord, whatever, and I record something between a half an hour to an hour, just some historical background and some topics that interest me, topics that I do my research on and teach and et cetera, et cetera. And right now, going on with that, I have what was initially just going to be a one or two part series, but was slowly developing into a 4 or 5 or 12 or 200 part series on the history of Russia. And I had a lot of fun recording this on Friday because my intention on Friday was to take it from Peter the Great all the way through to the Russian Revolution. But I was doing a little bit of rereading on Robert K. Massey's Catherine the Great, Portrait of a Leader, which I talked about last week. And I just really, really, I'm really, really passionate, not just about the way that, I'm not just passionate about Catherine the Great and her accomplishments and everything. I'm passionate about the way that she's portrayed as a leader too. And, you know, I talk about this in the historical extra, but it's interesting to me, and it's always fascinating, actually, if you look back on history at the very rare instances of prominent female leaders in Western democracies. And to no one's individual fault, I mean, it's a collective way that we research history. So much of what we talk about when it comes to female, powerful female leaders in history has to do with things that have nothing to do with their accomplishments. And what I mean by that, you'll hear in my historical extra, but I talked a lot about the difference between how we evaluate the accomplishments of a leader like Catherine the Great versus the accomplishments of Tsar Alexander, who came after her, whose accomplishments were very much more at the time lauded in Russia, even though he more stumbled into his accomplishments, whereas Catherine the Great very much pursued hers and earned hers somewhat through subterfuge and somewhat through devious means, but nonetheless... and, you know, a book like Robert Massey's book does so much to try and recapture the narrative of Catherine the Great and turn it away from all the urban legends and all these silly stories about her that everyone knows, you know, and turn it back into, you know, here's what she accomplished on an imperial end. Here's what she accomplished for the empire. Here's what she accomplished for arts and sciences. I mean, she wrote individually the books that were to become the basics for the education system in Russia. Their social education system. So she's a really important character. And I hope if you have any interest in Russian history, you take the time to listen to the historical extra. Next time around, I'll be hopefully taking it into the end of the Romanovs and the Russian Revolution. But I have a ton of stories for that too. So who knows? I might get stuck somewhere towards the end of the 19th century.
I think these are going very, very well. I'm enjoying these, Dan. I'm so glad that you're bringing all this awesome knowledge to everyone out there listening, because it's, I mean, it's just super, super cool to learn about these historical figures. I mean, those are stories that you're clearing up some stuff out there that's been a little misconstrued over the years.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Valter, do you want to tell us about your strategy tip of the week?
Yes, today I'm going to be talking about China for my strategy tip and see how they are going, what you should pretty much do to make the most out of them. Well, of course, they are really strong in the early game. Always when you play against China, they're always complaining about, hey, stop building those wonders, those are mine. And that is pretty much what they're really, really good at. Their builders get an additional charge, which is amazing throughout the rest of the game. I really, really think this is a really powerful mechanic just for the extra builder charge that it gets. It gets better, though, because you can actually rush wonders a little bit with that by using one of your charges, and it completes it by 15%. Pro tip, go for pyramids. You get a free worker out of it, and your workers gain another additional charge for the rest of the game. So if you go with China, go try and make the pyramids with them. Build a worker just for that, and you will get a worker back out of it with an extra charge again. So it's benefited all the way there. And beyond that, China is also really strong with their dynastic cycle. Because what it does is normally the Eurekas give you 50% bonus. This actually gives you 60% bonus. Doesn't sound like much, but actually is a lot. And actually, I would recommend you guys to go after those Eurekas and inspirations more than you normally would. Go out of your way to actually actively pursue the ones that you know you're going to take in the near future, because that 60% bonus, that can save you so much time. And remember that the inspiration that you gain for that civics also counts to the amount of culture you've generated for your domestic tourists. So if you want to deter somebody from winning a tourist victory, just go after a couple of inspirations.
There you go.
And then, of course, yeah, and they can win a cultural game themselves quite well as well, because the Great Wall is awesome. The Great Wall is one of the few unique tile buildings that I really like, because you can place them in places that don't matter at all to your empire, just empty plots that you will never work in your whole life, and you will actually get something out of that. Tourism. And tourism is actually a thing that is quite scarce usually. So just build a nice segmented wall around your borders, like you should. I mean, it's a wall. And you can do that even late in the game and get beautiful tourism out of it. It's awesome. It's great. And you can win the game pretty well with that. So, yeah, don't touch the Crouching Tiger, though, because they suck.
I got triggered, Kyle, by the fact that he had the term big wall and beautiful within like three or four words of each other. I don't know about you. I mean, I love China in this game, but that was a little much for me.
Well, you know.
China did it first.
China did it first. There you go. Well, everybody, thank you so much for joining us for another episode of CivCast. We have a blast broadcasting these live on Twitch, YouTube, and Mixer. So hopefully you can hang out with us on one of these upcoming Sundays. Enjoy some of our banter live. Big thanks to Copper Cutters for joining us live again, as always, in the chat. We encourage you guys to do that. Just shoot us your questions while the show's going on. Chime in on our debates. That is thanks to all of our supporters over at patreon.com/CivCast. So we recommend you guys go over there. We got a new goal set up, so you can check that stuff out. That's going to be me going and doing a deep dive into some older Civ games. If we hit that goal, that'll be super, super fun. We'll live stream it. You guys can hang out for that as well. Go check out Dan's historical extra that he just put up there. That was up there as a Friday night, so it's there now. It's fresh and new. Valter's going to be coming to us with a new strategy session shortly. Oh, I can't do that in one sentence. It just doesn't work. But he's going to be coming to us with that. So that's going to be really fun. You guys will get to do a deep dive into some new tips here, which will be very, very exciting. We're going to have all these CivCast challenge rolls up on our subreddit. That is civcast.reddit.com. That'll be a sticky post at the top of the page. And below that should be our show notes from this week, so you can find links to anything that we talked about. Dan and I are going to have to chat about a book club thing posting on Reddit at some point. That's coming down the pipe. We know we've teased that to you guys. We're going to work on that soon. What else? We kind of, just as a reminder, we kind of put the Twitter on hiatus so that we can focus more effort on the subreddit. it here. So if you're going over to our CivCast Twitter and trying to find new things, it is intentionally a ghost town. Don't worry about it. It's very, very intentional. Links to all the shows, you can go to civcastpodcast.com. We got everything there. You can find the CivCast page with all the, like I said, links to iTunes, all those other great places, some live streaming links and all that. At the bottom, you're going to find a contact us block. We highly encourage you guys to use that. You can shoot us an email with anything you might want to send into the show, any thoughts. And our email is civcastpodcast@gmail.com. I believe that wraps it up for us this week, guys. We did an awesome talk about Civ 5. I had tons of fun. So until next week, just one more turn. You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. For more shows like this, visit kyledempsterstudios.com.